the appeal to a class interest requires actually the at least sketching out of an alternative social order, which makes it very different from the appeal to market interests. If you go all the way back to Lukács, right? What's his central message? Class consciousness is a consciousness of class, meaning that coming to an understanding of one's class interests is at the same time coming to an understanding that one holds a specific kind of structural position in the whole society. And at the same time, coming to an understanding that we could have different kinds of societies, right? So this is why it's so difficult to achieve, right? Because the most immediate economic interests are those that are given on the market. And they are the most obviously appealable to, right? Class interests require the at least intuition that there's a different sort of society that is possible. This is also why when we speak of the emergence of class interest or an awareness of class, it also requires us to understand that in the context of a specific state of class struggle. That is to say, it is not the case that classes have interests over which they subsequently struggle. It is the case that classes come to understand, and this is particularly true for wage earners, they come to understand their interests as a class in the context of a class struggle.
Welcome back to BungaCast. I'm Alex Oculi in São Paulo, Brazil, joined by contributing editor Lee Jones in London. Now, what is the connection between the evolution of capitalism since the 1980s and the structure of politics that's emerged in the rich world, particularly in the US, since the financial crisis of 2007-08? That's a question in its different permutations that we've been looking to answer on BungaCast since we started 9 years ago. But those words in specific belong to Dylan Riley, who's our guest today. Dylan Riley is professor of sociology at UC Berkeley. I'm sure many listeners will be familiar with his work. Welcome, Dylan.
Thanks for having me, Alex. It's great to talk to you both.
Yeah, it's fantastic to have you back. It's been over 3 years since you were last on, and I'm very eager to discuss what we're going to be discussing today. Now, for those who don't know, Dylan Riley and Robert Brenner set off, I think, one of the most concentrated and serious debates on the left in recent times with their essay, Seven Theses on American Politics, published in 2022 in the New Left Review. And possibly the most contentious claim or the one that generated the most debate regarded the emergence of so-called political capitalism. But the essay also dealt with crucial political consequences emerging from the reality of low-growth capitalism, of secular stagnation, and in particular the material but non-class politics that has emerged, especially but not only in the U.S. And we're going to inquire into all of that. So we're going to start by talking a bit about political capitalism. We'll then move on to some, I think, geoeconomic aspects, people now like to refer to it as, before concluding on the politics of the matter, both in the US and indeed perhaps beyond that. So Dylan, to get started, you write, political leaders and capitalists have quite openly allied in promoting new practices to appropriate the surplus product. We have termed, this is you and Robert Brenner writing, we have termed the resulting combination, still taking shape, political capitalism. So what do you mean by political capitalism and what are its main features?
It's a great question. Let me just, maybe the way of getting into that most effectively is to begin with what we could say is, you know, classical capitalism or non-political capitalism, and then develop the notion of political capitalism by contrast to that. So I want to just say that the reason that I think you could say the reason that we care about capitalism, the reason that it's such a distinctive sort of system of social production, is that in a capitalist economy, you have firms that are competing on price with one another. And as they compete on price, they attempt to increase the productivity of labor by investing in machinery and means of production to produce their commodities at a lower price than their competitors. And this has been the key to achieving really what we call economic growth. Sometimes economists call it modern economic growth or other things of that sort. And the key idea is that in a sense, capitalists as a group, as an ownership class, have been historically distinctive in depending largely on reaping the gains of productivity as the basis of sort of their profits, their surplus. And we could say that, our intuition, that is to say, Brenner and mine's intuition, is that something began to change at a very deep level around about 1980 in this kind of strategy of you could say, profit seeking. And what changed was largely that investment in actual, machinery and organization of production, investment in those kinds of things that really increased productivity became less important as a source of surplus. And what really stepped into its place, largely, I would say, a series of strategies to manipulate the prices of assets, and particularly to increase their value without investment in means of production. And so it was a kind of a form of profitability that really was based on what you could think of as asset price inflation. And this asset price inflation itself rested on a set of basically political mechanisms, and primarily the policies of central banks, but not just central banks, also tax policies and other things of that sort. And what these had the effect of doing was allowing for asset prices to appreciate, and therefore allowing capitalists to, reap the gains of that appreciation without investing in production. And you saw that it manifests itself, we could say, in the rich world, primarily through declining rates of investment and ultimately in slower economic growth. And this is a kind of new regime. That's kind of what we're suggesting. Now, there are lots of other things that are going on here. There are other kinds of ripoffs, but that's kind of the central mechanism that I'd like to really emphasize.
I think this has probably been the most controversial aspect of your original essays, the idea of political capitalism, the label, the idea that it constitutes a new regime of accumulation within capitalism. Mm-hmm. I'd just like to push you a bit on it. So, why choose the term political capitalism? I mean, some people would say this is a kind of contradiction in terms, particularly if we think about the way that Robert Brenner himself historically understood capitalism as and distinguished it from feudalism as being about the extraction of surplus value from workers through non-political or purely economic means. Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, it looks like political capitalism is a contradiction in terms, or is no longer capitalism itself. And a kind of related question would be, you claim in the article that raw political power rather than productive investment is the key determinant of the rate of profit, I think. Is that really true? That it's the key determinant, raw political power? It could be that it's a more important one at particular moments in time. It's become more important over the past 20 years. But is it really true to say it's the key determinant?
Yeah, no, I think those are both quite good questions. On the first one, I think there has been some discussion about whether, oh, well, we all know